We thank you, Ms. Amdur, for accepting the assignment and your vigorous advocacy for your client. We'll move to the fourth case of the morning, which is Theron McCain versus Retail Food Employees. Mr. Park.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Edgar Pauk. I'm co-counsel for Mr. McLean. This appeal concerns the issue of whether Congress intended to treat accruals differently from vesting with regard to breaks in service. And the problem is that the prior panel of this court did not ask the question but did not really analyze any of the regulations issued by either the Department of Labor or the IRS that clearly show or do a statutory analysis that would clearly have shown that Congress did intend to treat vesting differently than accruals. For vesting purposes, ERISA allows a plan to enforce its pre-ERISA break-in service provisions. For accrual purposes, however, once a person vests post-ERISA, it's quite clearly Section 204B4 of ERISA provides that for accrual purposes, a plan must take into account every year of participation since the earliest date of participation. In other words, we go back to the first time the person became a participant in the plan, and the only years of service or participation that can be ignored for purposes of calculating the benefit are those lost due to the rule of parity. That is, if a person, for instance, has 5 years of credit before the break, and then the break lasts 5 years or longer, those years are lost. If, however,
if we add those years back in under ERISA, would we be exposing the plan to a large unanticipated buyout? The plan couldn't have known that it would be held liable under ERISA for the years of service that were clearly excluded under contract. And it would have had no way to know that it should reserve for the payout, right?
Well, there's several answers to that. First of all, since this was dismissed, we have no record to show what the cost would be and how many people would be affected. This was dismissed on the pleadings. But in the second place, ERISA created lots of liabilities. For instance, before ERISA, very often there was no vesting at all prior to normal retirement age, or perhaps only after 25 or 30 years of service. ERISA provided that if a person had 1 hour of service after ERISA's effective date, that then the person, the person had 10 years of credit, the person would vest. Also, ERISA created an accrual schedule. Before ERISA, many plans did not provide for any accrual. You either received your full benefit if you met all the requirements at retirement, or you received nothing. ERISA provided a graduated schedule of accruals. If a plan was uncertain as to the consequences of ERISA on accruals, it could have certainly sought a declaratory judgment, or it could have highlighted the issue to the Internal Revenue Service and asked for the Internal Revenue Service's view on the matter. The plan did not do that, and they just the Second Circuit, in looking at this matter, both at the statutory language and the regulations, decided the matter was so clear that they actually would not even look at the regulations, because the statutory language was very, very clear. It talks about the earliest date of participation. And also, it's quite clear that for accrual purposes, ERISA looks at years of participation. For vesting purposes, it looks at years of service. Years of service are defined as 1,000 hours. Years of participation are not defined. It can be whatever the plan provides. It's up to the plan, but of course, it cannot ignore participation of 1,000 hours or more. But it is certainly free to provide a full credit for 400 hours of participation.
Surely, Mr. Palk, someone must have asked for cert on one of these cases. Has CERT
not
always
so far.
Really?
Not as far as I know. As far as I know, this has not happened because, as you know, before this court decided the issue, there were two or three other cases which really did not look into the matter very strictly. In fact, Judge Posner referred to those decisions as being not reasoned at all. Now, Judge Posner, in deciding in 1994 in Jones v. UOP, did agree that apparently ERISA did treat them differently, but he said, well, the plaintiff did not explain why Congress would have done that. Well, first of all, that's not the right question. If Congress did it, it didn't matter why it did it. But it's quite simple why it did it, because it wanted to help people with long years of pre-ERISA service. If those people had a pre-ERISA break in service, they lost all those prior years. So they would have to start from scratch to accumulate the 10 years required by ERISA for cliff vesting. If eventually they did vest, then there would be a look back. After all, contributions were made on behalf of this person. Those contributions were not thrown away. The employers contributed. This is part of, it's a deferred part of salary, of compensation. Contributions were made, and over all these years, these contributions earned interest or whatever, they were invested. They earned money for the plan. We're not talking about a gift. Also remember that under pre-ERISA, many plans have very short breaks in service, 6 months, sometimes 6 months, and you would lose all your years of service. That affected a lot of women who took maternity leave, for example, but a lot of other people with long years of service. Mr. McLean had 15 years of service. Then he had the break, 15 years, and there was no vesting pre-ERISA, and Congress obviously intended to help these people with long years of service to help them recapture these years, if they vested. If they never came back after ERISA, then those years were lost.
Speaking of years, at times, the brief refers to 16 years of service, and at other times, 21 years. By my count, it would be 16. Is it 15, 16?
Well, I believe it's 15 years. The first period was 15 years. It was followed by a break of about 11 years, and then he came back for 10 more years, and then he vested, approximately. I remember this is fairly approximate, but the point is that the break in service was smaller than the years of credited service. You also have to remember that you cannot engraft the vesting provisions of ERISA into the accrual provisions without engrafting all the other provisions as well. For example, for vesting, the minimum age was 22. For participation, it was 25 or 30, depending on a particular plan. There's no way of plucking one requirement from the vesting provisions and putting them into the accrual provisions without really creating confusion in the whole statutory scheme. I'll reserve the rest of time for rebuttal.
Okay, fine.
Thank you.
Mr. Gilden?
Good morning, Your Honors. Juris Gilden on behalf of defendants appellees. The plaintiff in this case invites this court to overturn its prior holding in Jones versus UOP. In doing so, what it's really inviting is for this court to overturn the carefully constructed internal architecture which ERISA represents. In short, what this plaintiff wants is for this court to find that the accrual rules trump the vesting rules. This is not how ERISA works. ERISA has a set of overlapping, interwoven rights, starting with vesting, going through participation, and then down to accrual. It's clear that if you don't reach your vesting stage, the accrual, the participation credits or service mean nothing. Therefore, vesting is at the top of this hierarchy. For example, you can earn your years of credit or accrual prior to vesting, quit prior to vesting, stay away longer than your break in service would allow, the break in service rule would allow, come back, perform post-break service long enough to vest. And it's perfectly clear from ERISA that under those circumstances, you do not get credit for your pre break, service for purposes of participation, or accrual. That is true beyond any doubt in this case. If we were here and all of the relevant events in this case took place post-ERISA, in other words, this plaintiff in this matter worked, started work, took a break before he vested. His break then lasted long enough so that it went beyond the post-ERISA break in service allowance, the rule of parity, if you will, in 202. Came back, started again, worked long enough to vest, and then ultimately retired, there'd be no doubt that he would not get any credit for his pre-break service. That's how ERISA works. Now, plaintiff here wants to somehow use the ERISA rule to create greater rights for pre-ERISA service than would be true under post-ERISA service.
Now, pre-ERISA, he had, I guess we agree, 16 years?
He had 16 years.
And,
right.
And obviously, post-ERISA, what is it, just requires 10 years for vesting? Is that?
It's 5 years now.
Is it 5 years now? So it's not a long time. That's, I guess, what the distinction you're saying is, that even though there was no vesting pre-ERISA, that under the rules then existing, he wouldn't vest, but now ERISA would then create this vesting. Is that the... If you applied the accrual rules,
right, I think
it would override the vesting. Is that
that's right. I think that's plaintiff's argument, is that the accrual rules, by looking at the accrual rules in Section 204 in isolation, somehow they override the pre-arrest ERISA vesting rules, which are which existed pre-arrest without control by federal litigation, and post-ERISA are controlled by Sections 202 and 203. I think what this case boils down to is we have a disagreement about which break-in-service rules apply, not which rules apply under the accrual. Now, break-in-service rules are found in 202 and 203, not in 204. And the break-in-service rules in 202, called the rule of parity, establish a limitation on how long an employee can be out before his pre-break service is not counted. It establishes it by statute. Now, the rule of parity, if it applied to this case, would make this participant, make the plaintiff, eligible for the credits going backward, even pre-ERISA. But the rule of parity can't apply in this case. There's nothing in Section 202 which establishes the rule of parity that says the rule of parity is retroactive. It would indeed be a surprising result because, as was pointed out, when the parties all made their decisions and made their actuarial computations and made their plans about what they were going to do about pensions and about quitting and or about not quitting and about retiring back pre-ERISA, everyone knew that the plaintiff did not vest. So to then use the post-ERISA rule to reorganize or restructure these expectations would be a surprising result. It would go against the rule that presumes against retroactivity that is announced in Landsgraf. It would go against the general ban on retroactivity that appears in ERISA. It would go against the Northern District's decision in First Midwest Bank Court, which actually looked at whether or not the rule of parity was retroactive and found that it was not. But most of all, and most importantly to this case, it would conflict with the express terms of ERISA in the Section 203 exception. The Section 203 exception about vesting and about what service counts towards vesting specifically treats, it expressly treats, and it clearly treats the issue at heart of this, at the heart of this case, which is...
Oh, go ahead. No.
Which is, do the pre-ERISA break in service rules, or the rules applied by the plan to pre-ERISA breaks in service, continue to have life post-ERISA? The exception says they do. As long as they appear in the plan that existed at the time that ERISA became applicable, which in this case was June 1, 1976.
Now, am I wrong in thinking that under your reading, an employee with continuous service would benefit even if his service was brief, but that a long-term employee with even a short break in service would not benefit?
That's correct. In other words, an employee could start before ERISA, just a few years before ERISA, and then his participation would be counted because the Section 203 rule requires it.
But
and the Section 203 rule.
How ought we reconcile that with the congressional intent to protect long-term employees?
Well, because I think that the 203 exception was expressly and consciously created by Congress to create an exception where there's breaks in service under the terms of the plan in effect at the time that ERISA became applicable. And I think that was done for the very reason raised here, which is, you know, if somebody works and he knows the rule is that if he leaves and he leaves for so long, he doesn't have any rights, and the plan makes its actuarial predictions based on that set of circumstances and that relationship, to then go back and impose new liabilities would work harm to the plan. It would work harm to the system which Congress was trying to create. So that what Congress created in 204 was a system that protected certain rights of accumulation, because that 204 is directed at the backloading problem. Congress didn't want a backloading scheme, whether pre-ERISA or post-ERISA. And it created an express way to prevent it in Section 204. On the other hand, Congress apparently wanted to preserve the breaks in service rules and therefore created an express way to protect them in 203. So 204 doesn't apply to this at all because it's not a backloading case. If it were a backloading case, we might have a different result. But that's because 204 is intended to protect rights, assuming they are vested. 204 is not intended to create a right to vest that did not otherwise exist. And that's the distinction here. The plaintiff wants to create a right to vest that would not have and did not exist absent ERISA. And there's nothing in ERISA that requires that. In fact, ERISA allows the plan to not create a vesting right that was different than what existed pre-ERISA. So I think what's happened here is that the plaintiff is focusing on the wrong statutory section in isolation. This is a very highly reticulated, complex statute, and the rights all are interwoven. But there's a hierarchy. This is not like the childhood game of rock, scissors, paper. Rock is vesting, scissors is participation, and paper is accrual. Paper doesn't go around and trump rock. Rock trumps paper, scissors and paper. That's the rule. That's the way ERISA works. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, I should have brought my kids today, huh?
They at least would have known the analogy.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Paul?
I'm afraid that the argument of defendant counsel ignores the statutory language. If Section 204 meant to refer to 203 for breaks in service, it would have cross-referenced to Section 203. In fact, Section 204, which talks about accruals, cross-references quite clearly to Section 202B, which contains the rule of parity. That cannot be escaped. The other thing is, talking about retroactivity, well, ERISA presents a lot of retroactive provisions. In terms of actuarial factors, it was, unless someone was able to reach a certain age and a number of years of service, all the years of service will count for nothing, because they will lose everything pre-ERISA unless they were able to reach age 65 or 62 with 20 to 25 years of service. Well, ERISA says no. We are going to give you a rate of accrual for your service right from year one, and we're going to allow you to vest. In fact, under ERISA, One of the vesting rules was a 15-year vesting. That is, after 5 years of service, you were vested 25%. That created a much greater liability than could have been expected before ERISA, obviously, because the actuarial factors were different. Now, many more people would vest. The other thing why it's important for this court to take another look is that we are talking about many national plans. The rights cannot depend on where the lawsuit is brought. Whether somebody vested or not cannot depend on whether the suit is brought in the Seventh Circuit or on the Second Circuit. So before you create a conflict between the circuits or perpetuate this conflict between the circuits, you should take a hard look to see whether the Second Circuit was right. And somebody is going to go to the Supremes from one place or the other.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
I should just mention, Mr. Pauk, that Judge Posner loved the last page of your reply.
He liked the Latin.
I made sure that he saw it.
Thank you. The case will be taken under advisement.